Okay, so this lecture is called The Lure of the East, the 18th Century Philosophical and Oriental Tale. The story critics tell of the rise of the novel in the 18th century is that the realist novel, concerned with individual character and with domestic affairs, rapidly silences more fantastic and didactic forms. These forms, popular in the 17th and early 18th century, we're told, privileged plot rather than complex character construction. Forms such as the fairy tale, the oriental tale, the short tale of seduction and betrayal. So in this lecture, I want to suggest that this is a false distinction. The evidence of the success of the philosophical and the oriental tale in the 1760s is that these tales offer alternative means of exploring the same preoccupations as those that drive the more familiar realist and domestic fiction of the second half of the 18th century. So we might think as examples of realist and domestic fiction of works such as Henry Fielding's Tom Jones, Samuel Richardson's Pamela, Tobias Smollett's Humphrey Clinker, Francis Burney's Evelina, all now reckoned to have established that tradition of the domestic and realist novel. I want to suggest that in Oriental and philosophical tales, we likewise find a fiction which is self-consciously exploring relations between reader and text, between disciple and mentor, between past and present generations, the same relations that are driving the inquiry of the domestic and realist novel in the same period. Where philosophical and oriental tales differ from the domestic realist fictions is that they explore these relations on the level of form and plot rather than on the level of character. So it's not that character is insignificant in these tales, but that it tends to demonstrate the universality of the human mind and the common responses of that mind in different persons to external stimuli. Their realist and domestic counterparts, by comparison, are designed rather to promote our belief in the plausibility or authenticity of the persons they render through delivering them individualizing marks or impressions. By the mid-18th century, the repertoire of elements in the Oriental and philosophical tale was established. It encompasses the following. There's a central protagonist, whether an observer and auditor of tales or a character within them, and sometimes both. This character undergoes an educational experience, a sequence of events that often involves travel from one territory to another, and sometimes the contrast of Oriental and Occidental cultures or norms. We also usually find a genius character, usually an older man, sometimes a supernatural agent, a genie, who provides instruction and advice to a protagonist in order to prepare him, and it's rarely a her, for future government. In terms of style, we can detect a number of things. There's a kind of conscious archaism and extravagance associated with Oriental style. It's often manifested in the speech of characters. Lots of thusing and thouing. In terms of politics, we see a critique of despotism, often expressed through complaint about the oppression and confinement of women in Oriental cultures. During the first 5 years of the 1760s, several Oriental and philosophical tales were published, which were clearly seeking to capitalise on the success of Samuel Johnson's 1759 story, Rasselas. Rasselas is a short tale which describes the travels of a young Abyssinian prince. He escapes the happy valley of his home. There he's felt himself imprisoned, despite its happiness and comfort and luxuriousness, because it doesn't help him to pursue the inquiries he's interested in government and education. So he escapes the Happy Valley, seeks out to determine for himself the best models of good government in the state and family in the wider world. He's accompanied by a wise poet, the genius figure, who's called Imlac, his sister, Rasselas's sister Nakaya, and his sister's maid Pekua. But the little company are not in the end left with a satisfying solution to the questions they ask. I'm going to consider here some examples of texts that follow in Rasselas's footsteps, and I want to suggest that they reveal two different ambitions for the Oriental tale of this second half of the 18th century. First, the use of an Oriental setting serves as a warning to Occidental governments to avoid errors in their own style and method of government. So here the East is acting as an analogue to the West, precisely because of its assumed difference. Second, the use of an Oriental setting can serve to tell a story about the power of story itself, the power of fiction to convert those who are subject to another form of despotism, the absolutism of the individual will. So story can undermine the absolutism of a governing power, or the absolutism that drives our own wills. Story can teach identification with others and an imaginative connection with their life stories rather than preoccupation with one's own. So here, the Oriental tale demonstrates the universality of human response, that the desires found in the Orient are no different from those found in the Occident. So to turn to my first example, Johnson was succeeded as compiler of the parliamentary debates for the Gentleman's Magazine by a man called John Hawkesworth. And Hawkesworth published in 1761 an Oriental tale titled Almoran and Hammett. He dedicated this fevered tale of rivalry between twin male heirs to the throne of Persia to the new King George III. The tale is a thinly veiled allegory and compliment to George, whose character, if favourably represented, was close to that of the virtuous twin, Hammett. He was shy, devout, and domestic. George's devotion to his councillor friend Lord Bute, whom he swiftly made Prime Minister, estranging William Pitt from power, is evidently mirrored in Hammett's relationship to his loyal adviser, Omar. By comparison, there's an evil genius who's steering the active, aggressive, and despotic twin Almoran to his downfall. Almoran and Hammett concerns a conflict between two brothers whose father has left them in equal control of his kingdom. A genius provides the envious twin Almoran with the power to adopt the appearance of others, and he uses this power to substitute for his brother and court a lovely commoner called Almeida. And he also uses it to attempt to seize power from Hammett once the people have expressed a preference for Hammett to be their single sovereign. Almoran's overreaching, of course, receives fit punishment. He pronounces the mystic words that have been given to Hammett as a protective charm, only to find a genius appear who announces, he says, "I've been appointed to perfect virtue by adversity and in the folly of her own projects to entangle vice." Almoran is turned into stone, leaving his worthy brother, his backbone strengthened from these experiences, to rule alone but with the aid of wise counsel. So here we see the Oriental tale serving as counsel to those who govern about how to win love, and to the governed to expect sympathetic government. Two short tales of the 1760s demonstrate the continuing attraction of another objective of the Oriental tale, here to promote simple moral truths by presenting to readers a tale in which the central character is reformed through a fictional vision. And I'm going to give you two examples here. The first is Oliver Goldsmith's Azem, or The Man-Hater, which was published as number 16 of Goldsmith's Essays in 1765. And the second is Francis Sheridan's short fiction, The History of Nourjahad, which appeared in 1767. Goldsmith tells us that his central protagonist, Azem, has retired to a cave at the foot of a mountain in Tauris in disgust at the ingratitude of those friends he supported generously when he was affluent. Azem is about to take his own life by drowning when a genie approaches him across the waves and spirits him to a world which has been designed by the Prophet Muhammad, and it's a world in which perfect reason prevails and there is no vice. Azem, though, is very disappointed to discover here a world without arts, without friendship, and a population terrorised by wild animals. The population is living at subsistence level in great unhappiness. Azem decides that the world designed by Allah, which incorporates countervailing vice with virtues, is better than the rational universe imagined by his prophet. He heads back to his native town and engages in commerce, where he repairs his fortune and happiness. So here a fictional vision teaches a man-hating character that luxury and commerce is actually central to human happiness. Frances Sheridan, like others before her, presents her experiment in the Oriental tale as a text designed to instruct a potential monarch, and on this occasion it's George III's son, also called George. Unusually, however, the tale focuses on the correction of an errant counsellor rather than a badly behaved monarch. Shemseddin, the young king of Persia, is testing his close friend Nourjahad, and he asks him to confide his fondest wish. He's disappointed when Nourjahad, instead of saying he wants to be a good counsellor and loyal friend, says he'd like vast wealth and immortality. A guardian genius, a lovely young boy, visits Nur Jahad to offer him a chance that night of fulfilling his wish or enjoying once again the Sultan's favour. Once again, Nur Jahad chooses against the friendship, chooses the treasure, and embarks on a life of luxury. However, he finds himself prey to the genius's curse that when he succumbs to evil, he'll fall asleep for many years and wake to find his world changed around him. After a succession of traumatic reawakenings, he finally repents, only to be sentenced to death for exercising his newfound benevolence against the edict of a newly ascended king. His execution is averted, however, by the disclosure that Nur Jahad has been the victim of a trick orchestrated by Shemseddin. It has, in fact, only been 14 months since the first visit from his genie, and that part, the lovely young boy, was being played by a lady called Mandana, who'd fallen in love with Nur Jahad and sought Shemseddin's assistance to win his love. Shemseddin concludes the tale with his moral. He says, "Let this dream of existence then be a lesson to thee for the future, never to suppose that riches can ensure happiness, that the gratification of our passions can satisfy the human heart, or that the immortal part of our nature will suffer us to taste unmixed felicity in a world which was never meant for our final place of abode." Nur Jahad is given Mandana for a wife and becomes the Sultan's first minister, a role he conducts so virtuously that his name, we're told, was famous throughout the Eastern world. So once again, we have here a kind of manufactured fiction, a performance, a play, which is staged in order to correct errant behaviour and to bring someone back to love, to sociability, to companionship. In both Goldsmith's and Sheridan's tales, an encounter with a carefully designed fiction provides the means to restore a character to active engagement with the real world. This is the special magical effect, I want to suggest, of the Oriental philosophical tale. It demonstrates the power of fiction to change behaviour in the real world. And of course, its most famous teller, Scheherazade, in the Oriental sequence, The Thousand and One Nights, which is first translated in the early 18th century into English from French, from its original Arabic. So Scheherazade also uses fiction to cure an auditor. In her case, the despotism of her terrible husband. And it saves not only her people, but her own lovely neck from execution. So it's the sheer power of storytelling to conjure up alternative worlds and offer us opportunities to respond affectively, so with feeling, and critically, with judgment, to those worlds, which is told in these tales. Readers of the tales, like the protagonists within them, find themselves transported by the arts of fiction to other worlds, which in turn restore them, renewed, if only by skepticism, to the world they inhabit.